Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's January 30th, 2022, and welcome to episode 250 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and 72nd anniversaries. I am Paul near Boston, and I am joined today by two retro computing enthusiasts, the first of whom is Earl Evans in Portland. How are you?
I'm amazingly super fantastic. Take that, Carrington.
And also joining us is Carrington Vanston in Toronto. How are you?
I am Earl plus plus.
Excellent.
Whatever he was, and one more.
I can see there's no end to this.
How are you?
I am fine. We just had a big blizzard here. Set records of various sorts, but I didn't have to shovel any of it, so that was all fine. Put the car in a parking garage. And people who were taking care of neighboring parking lots turned out to have, like, plowed out the stuff that that we own, so that's good. So anyway, I can just enjoy the records, and that's it.
Glad you're okay.
Thanks. What's your snow level, Carrington? Did you get hit by this?
My personal level for snow is low. No, we did not. We got hit a few weeks ago, and still have all of that. It's too cold to snow. It's one of those days where it's so cold it can't snow.
Yeah,
that's awesome, huh?
Nice.
Some of those days where it's like it would like to snow. But it's too cold. It's minus everything outside.
Mm-hmm. Minus Carrington.
Like I think I was joking on a podcast yesterday. The local news has just switched to Kelvin, and it's just like we're just giving up. Yeah. It's 7 outside, and goes a little colder, and all molecules will cease movement. It's very cold in Toronto. Oh well.
Hello.
Oh well. For some reason, people in my family who came before me picked this place. And I'm stuck with their decision, apparently.
Yep. How's the snow in Portland?
We have zero snow. And
all right.
I am okay with that.
Suck.
In fact, we've had quite a bit of sunshine, but today it's cloudy. It's kind of rainy. I'm happy to be inside.
Yeah.
It's been cold, but not Carrington cold, like Portland cold.
Nothing's Carrington cold.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, colder than LA, where I'm from, but warmer than Toronto. So I'm happy.
Excellent. Yeah, it's sunny enough here that we have birds that will visit us on our kitchen window, and we had a couple, like, you know, sleeping in the sun earlier today, which is kind of cute. But yeah, I don't actually know what the downstairs neighbor's opinion of our feeding the birds on our window is, but at least it's cool for us anyway.
We have my girlfriend and I have bingo.
Yep.
Check. She's got some bird feeders on her window, like stuck on the window, mm-hmm. that you feed the birds to, same thing. And we normally get this squirrel-proof bird seed because the squirrels go in and they just chuck all the seed everywhere. They just won't share. If they would share nicely, they could have it. So we normally get squirrel-proof, which is, I guess, kind of hot. The whole point is it's spicy and birds, I guess, can't taste spice. Mm-hmm. So you can put up this spicy bird seed and they just eat it. But the place we get the bird seed from was out of the spicy food. So what is a person to do? Well, the bird seed place says you buy any bird seed and here's this like stuff you can put on it. It's like just like habanero liquid or whatever, and it makes it super spicy, but it makes it like insanely can't breathe for human spicy. Like if you touch it and touch your face, you're doomed. So two things have come out of this. One, my girlfriend did it first, got spice all over the place, touched her eyes with it, removed her contacts with it, and she's basically now doomed and blind forever. So wow. And she likes Szechuan stuff, and so it's crazy spicy. But I started thinking, I was watching these birds this morning actually in the bird feeder, and they just like stick their little heads in to find the seeds they want, and they come up and you can see they're kind of stained with this stuff.
Oh my.
I'm thinking, a cat or something eventually. It's unfortunate truth of nature that cats will eventually like eat occasional birds. Whatever. But cats that eat the birds around her house are now going to be like, oh my God, super spicy. And it may be that we will train all the local fauna that birds are too spicy to eat. And there will be a bird explosion because all the animals will be afraid like to eat the birds because they're like too super spicy. So we're raising a generation of incredibly spicy birds in Etobicoke. And I'll check back in 6 months and let you know how that works.
Very nice. All right. That's pretty cool. I like that idea. Cause you know, we also like our birds. We don't want anything bad to happen to them. This seems like a good
solution.
But
there's now a billion birds. She's got 3 feeders and there's her hedges are just like constantly, like hedges with opinions. And it'll be so loud. And you walk by and it's suddenly silence. And you walk by and then the hedges are up again, like scream. So there's a, I don't know how much the neighborhood likes that she's now raised a Disney princess amount of birds. But there's a lot of spicy birds in that part of Etobicoke right now.
That's funny. Yeah, they do have things to say when it is like sleeping time or whatever.
Yep.
Very loud trees around here.
Very
as well.
Very excited. The sun is up. The sun is up. Okay. Okay. Yes.
All right. So it has been 72 years since the paper that Turing published that it had contained the Turing test. I don't think it was called the Turing test in that paper, but I mean, like that was when it was sort of laid out. And so we thought this, you know, obviously this is what we should talk about because, you know, but the reasoning behind that is this is the 250th episode and, you know, there's not much, it wasn't clear what we would do with the number 250, but so what we're going to do is add 1700 to it and talk about things roughly related to the year that results in. So 1950 is where that ends up. For those who are math challenged, the paper was published in 1950, and so I thought maybe like the topic could be just sort of things that kind of relate to your experiences with AI. You know, probably largely it would be more interesting to talk about them in the past, but I mean, you know, I suppose there's also Siri, right? That's about as structured as it was, you know, like if you took AI classes, learned Lisp, you know, trained a dot to learn its environment. I don't know. What thoughts did that bring to mind or are that bringing to mind now that you are currently thinking about the topic you didn't think about ahead of time?
Yeah. Earl, what do you got?
Well, I'm fascinated conceptually with AI. Always have been. I took a logic class in university, and a lot of what we talked about was how people think, how people reason. And the instructor for the course was extremely bright, I think, as you should be if that's mm-hmm. a course that you're teaching. So I asked him, how long do you think it will be based on your assessment of technology and your assessment of how we think before computers could think like humans think? And he said he was guessing about 100 years. Now, I was thinking, you know, with Moore's Law and the inevitable, like, doubling of technology every X amount of time, I would guess it would be faster than that. But it's not just technology that does this. It's how the algorithms work, how people think. We might not be able to engineer it any faster than that. It really might be 100 years, maybe.
Mm-hmm. So that's how long humanity has.
Yeah, maybe. That's right. According to some of the doomsayers, yes. We might only have until then. So, party. I also took an AI class. And the interesting thing was, and we did use Lisp. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the courses that I really had to, man, I'm telling you, that course was a lot of work. And at the end of the course, I felt like I knew some things about Lisp, but I didn't really feel like I could apply what I learned to actual artificial intelligence. Like, how do I take these algorithms and techniques and now many parentheses that I had to use in this training and apply it to some real world problem where the computer would learn something, just could never get it. So I guess the thing I want to say is it's like magic to me. It's still like magic, even though I've looked into it, I've done some of my own study, I don't quite get how we're going to take computers and neural networks, and now the big thing is machine learning, you know, machine learning in the cloud. And you've got cloud providers that are pushing this on everybody, saying, you know, come buy our cloud offerings for machine learning and your business can make double the profits in half the time, and yada, yada, yada. And so far, I don't see businesses making double the profits in half the time with AI. So maybe it is still magic. I don't know. What do you guys think? And did you guys ever try Lisp?
I took a class that gave us an overview of Lisp, but barely used anything. What I took away from that was, for a year or so, my friends and I would say things like hungry pee, which is what you'd ask if people want to. That was basically what I took from Lisp, was just that joke and talking that way. Movies pee. And so that's what I got from Lisp. Machine learning to me is just captures, like, how many things in this grid are street signs. I feel like I am being learned. Like, it's like, let's teach Carrington how to tell if there's a car or an intersection in this group of things. So machines are slowly teaching me to do that, I guess. I don't have a background in AI. I don't have a background in machine learning. Been a programmer forever, but I have, like, no background in that stuff at all. Hardware development and AI are both kind of magic boxes to me. So they're just completely opaque. I really don't know what's going on there. So, alas.
Yeah, I know that I...
Question, Pete?
Yeah, no, I kind of wonder if everybody landed on that joke, but because we certainly did.
Everybody, right? Just, that's what, probably my professor said it, and we took it from that. Yeah. Or whatever. So, like,
there were only two people in my class, so
all right.
I guess
really,
it was extension learning, and they would make a commitment to
was that a special group?
It was an awesome group, actually. It was, you know, adults. We were working full time, going to school at night, and the university that I went to, Chapman University, said, we will make sure that we get you the classes that you need to graduate, even if there's only one or two people in the class. We're going to make that commitment to you. And they did, and they honored it. So we only had a couple people. We met at the Air Force Base. They did a lot of this off-campus teaching at the Air Force Base because they wanted to specifically offer it to members of the military so that they could take advantage of educational opportunities, which I thought was cool. So... there are just two of us, and so there really wasn't critical mass for in-jokes like that, I think.
Yeah. A lot of pressure not to drop the class, too, I would think.
Yes, indeed.
Right.
But that is always the problem with those, like, very low-number classes. Like, you oversleep or something, and it's like, well, everybody knows.
It was almost like being tutored. It really was. It was very cool. And the gentleman who taught the class, he worked at Intel, super duper sharp. Yeah, that was great. The other thing that I guess comment that I'd make about artificial intelligence is it's interesting that they were thinking about it as early as 1950, because you really didn't have computing power, I think, at that point, to be thinking about artificial intelligence, did you? So it was more conceptual than anything else. I've read the history about Stanford and how they, if I remember right, they had a couple camps there in the early days. One was the artificial intelligence camp that worked on AI specifically, and the other was the augmented intelligence camp that, you know, where they invented things like the mouse, and why is the gentleman's name jumped out of my head all of a sudden?
Engelbart.
Yeah, Doug Engelbart.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I guess I don't have enough actual intelligence. Anyway,
all of these things are abbreviated AI, I'm noticing too.
Yes. So the thing that I thought was interesting was that camp, the augmented intelligence camp, was like, we're not going to replace human intelligence with technology or computing, but what we can do is use kind of an amalgam of humans and technology together, and the result would be synergistic. It would be more than the sum of the parts. And I don't know. I guess we're still waiting to find out if that's true.
Yeah.
But, you know, but the internet's a pretty cool thing, and the mouse is a pretty cool thing. So, I, you know, hypertext. So I guess that's all cool. But, yeah, way back, they were thinking about artificial intelligence. And, you know, you're talking about computers with bytes full of memory, not even kilobytes or megabytes. So did you read that Turing paper? What did it say?
I didn't. I was thinking that as we were talking, I was thinking, you know, that would have been a good idea. But no, I haven't. I haven't actually read it. So perhaps I will before this makes it to the feed. But yeah, I know that. I mean, that was the idea of AI was certainly very, very, you know, attractive to me when I was a little kid. You know, like that I had my Apple II, and I think I had borrowed a book from the library about sort of like, you know, machine learning or artificial intelligence of some kind, but it was really sort of set in a microcomputer context. And so, I mean, I must've been like, I don't know what, 13 or something like that when I was reading this. And so it had these things, you know, like it's sort of talking through the concepts of, you know, having memory, that you know could change. So I gave this example of a dot, you know, running around learning its environment, and that was like one of the things the book was talking about. Like it has memory, but not enough to just memorize the space, you know. So you have a little dot, and you have to decide how it's going to alter memory when it hits things, so that it will, you know, it will learn something. And you know, it is learning of a sort. it isn't like take over the world kind of learning. It isn't master control program kind of learning. Or whatever, but yeah, I was really pretty into that, and I know there was a time like when I was an undergrad, even I was kind of into this and thinking like, you know, what I want to do is learn how to make a computer that I could talk to, you know, and so that, and actually that idea ended up leading me to take linguistics classes, which ended up with me doing linguistics professionally later and ditching all of this. You know, AI stuff, but just because it turned out to be actually a hard problem, like all the things that can do it, pretty much to date are faking it. You know, I mean, it's like, so our ability to fake it has become better. You know, it's Eliza was not bad.
I know the feeling.
I guess if you can make something that, and maybe this is where the Turing thing kind of goes to, if you can make something that fakes intelligence well enough to fool you into thinking it's intelligent, isn't it actually intelligent at that point?
Yep.
It's kind of one of those conceptual things.
Well, it's more intelligent than you.
Right. Right. Well, so one of the interesting programs that we had on demo for the Apple II, and you guys probably know this because you guys are Apple guys, there was a program that would ask you a question about an animal. It would say, does it fly? And you say, no, it doesn't fly. And it would say, oh, is it a dog? No, not a dog. It'll say, okay, tell me a question that would enable me to differentiate between what you picked. Say you picked a cat and a dog. So you give it a question, you give it the correct answer. And then it would ask a subsequent question. It'd be like, does it fly? Say no. It says, does it bark? And it would progressively gather more information about the animal kingdom. And by the time you were done, it could pick out, you know, it depended on how long you wanted to sit there and train it, but it could pick, you know, 50, 100 animals and ask you questions until it figured out which one was which. I guess that's not artificial intelligence, but it was learning. It was gathering information, and then it was practically implementing that information. So what program was that? Do you guys remember that program?
Yeah, it was called Animals, actually.
Oh,
yeah. There you go.
So, yeah, it's one of the, I think it must be at the top, near the top of the directory listing or something. But, you know, that's how you know you're looking at a system master, because it has animals on it.
Oh, okay. I want to run that again one of these days, because I remember being extremely impressed by that.
Yeah.
Back in the day.
We weren't supposed to tell him it was animals. You were supposed to tell him another question he could have asked to help differentiate which disc he was looking at.
That's right. I don't know. I mean, it does sort of, you know, I do get the feeling that it, at least at that point, back in the sort of 80s, a lot of it really was just kind of like trying to fool the user into believing, you know, the sort of anticipating the possible responses, you know, so that you would do this with like an adventure game, right? So you would have get, but you wouldn't have take or whatever.
We are slowly training the machines that humans don't lie, so that later we'll have an advantage.
Right. I'm not sure that it might be sort of different with these, you know, like once the computing power did get to the point where it could run, you know, very fast pattern recognizers that turned into the machine learning that's done now, you know, maybe things are actually different, you know, because then you're not actually giving it, you're not really training it so much. You know, you're just saying like, go observe the world. But
I guess maybe that's the difference, a practical thing to go learn about versus curiosity. Is the computer curious? I don't think so. Can it help solve problems through advanced pattern recognition? That it could do really well.
Yeah.
I think I've noticed over the last, I don't know, decade, between the advances in weather radar and the advances in computing that they use to process it, it seems like the weather prediction has gotten amazingly good compared to what it used to be. They could tell you 8, 9, 10 days ahead what if it's going to be
raining.
You're
going to forget a sweater.
What's that?
That you'll forget to bring a sweater.
Yes, you'll still forget. But that's not the computer's fault. But the computer can analyze tons of data from the satellites and Earth stations and stuff like that, put it all together, match it up with past experience, if you will, about what happened, and then spit out a thing that tells you it's going to rain on Tuesday. It's 40% chance it's going to rain on Tuesday, and it's pretty accurate.
Massive computing power to say, 40% chance it's going to rain. Yeah. I could do that with a lot less computer power.
Yeah. Well, that's actually one of the things I was thinking about is that, you know, in the context of what we talk about here, you know, all of that kind of stuff is pretty far out of reach. I mean, like, you know, what was kind of interesting about the AI attempts in the 80s or whatever was that you really didn't, you had to fake it because there was just, you couldn't simulate a brain. So you had to try to figure out like what shortcuts would work that would allow this not to take, you know, 3 days to get from prompt to response.
Yeah. I think, Curtis in the chat kind of summed it up. At best, I think the current status is targeted AI can do artificially intelligent things on a narrow targeted scope, but not dealing with things completely outside the AI's wheelhouse. So, yeah.
Right.
It's
so you get a Roomba.
Right.
Vacuum wise, but it's not going to go on a trip.
Exactly.
So you come home, the there's a note from the Roomba. From the Roomba, I've decided to go see Asia.
Yeah. Yeah, although, I think that's kind of been, this targeted AI thing has been kind of the way it's been almost from the start. I mean, you know, there's some early work about sort of like meaning processing that used scripts. I think it was, what's his name, Roger Schenck, was the guy who's associated with this. But, you know, like, so there's you know, and there's the example is always the same. It's like a restaurant and certain things happen in a restaurant and, so, you know, it can know what to do in that situation, but it can't handle, you know, an emergency like, you know, blizzard or something outside. Yeah, and the expert systems was brought up by Super Grover in the chat, and I'm wondering, I mean, I don't actually know what the relationship is between the current deep learning models and the, you know, neural net expert systems, but I think it's just a matter of degree, you know, that the early neural nets were just more simple networks, and the deep learning systems now are the same as the neural nets, except just like extruded.
Yeah. Expert system. I think the whole point was with an expert system, you're giving it its expertise. Like you enter all the inputs, you put all that stuff in there and it says, okay, now this is now an expert system versus like machine learning and all these other things are like, no, we just let it loose and let it learn.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think in all of these cases, I believe that it's still the case that, it's not entirely unguided. Like it does have to know under these conditions, this is the right answer, you know? But I mean, like, so the expert systems at the beginning were really like, you know, if you have these symptoms, this is the diagnosis. And it gave, you feed it a whole bunch of this medical data. And then later on it can intuit based on the symptoms, what the diagnosis is. The idea being that it's like, you know, like what an expert physician would do. I mean, like that they no longer actually just go through a checklist in their head, but they just know what the answer is. And that's what the idea is supposed to be here, is that this expert system will just know what the answer is. And it's funny because you don't actually, like, if you have put this together, you don't have any idea how it's arrived at that answer because it's way too complicated. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just weights and connections and stuff. And eventually it was right. Or either that, it's either right or it fails in some spectacular way. that is unlike any human, which is also funny. But so how's that for the Turing test?
We
1950
feel like we're
covered.
Done. Turing. We this podcast does not pass the Turing test.
Yeah.
I am going to go read that paper though. I'm interested. I imagine it. The writing may be somewhat terse and academic, but I think it's still going to be. How long is it? Don't know.
Who knows?
I will go check it out. If it's 100 pages or less, I will read it. If it's more than that, then the jury's out.
Yeah. I mean, my guess is that it is this, you know, part of it is mainly philosophy. You know, like since it's too hard to define what intelligence is, we will just, you know, have a kind of a functional way to determine it, you know. So sometimes they do that. I mentioned that I do linguistics, and like one of the things that comes up is like what meaning is, you know, and what does it mean to mean something? And, you know, people ponder hard about that. But a lot of times people just give up and say, like, this problem is not solvable. So we will instead just simulate this by saying, if you know the conditions under which something is true, you know what it means. So, and we will not get any deeper than that.
Even in mathematics, some things are axiomatic.
Yeah.
You get down to the bottom and it's like, I've reached the bottom turtle. I can't go any further than this. This is just defined. So that's okay.
Yeah. All right. So, yeah. So I think our plan is, you know, for the big 250, is that we'll start off a little string of things that are inspired by the year plus 1700. So, maybe we can think of something sensible to tie 1700 to, but at any rate, it just seemed like it was about the time to try something like this. So,
well, maybe we'll do something a little above and beyond for 256, because that's when we graduate to being a 9-bit podcast.
That's right. Oh, and you know, actually, looking ahead, one of the things that happened in 1956 was that the term byte was coined. So just after we escape the size of the byte, the term byte was termed. Yeah, but all right. Let's see. So maybe I can turn to listener feedback. So Retro Magazine, that got a mention a little while ago, and David on Facebook posted the fact that the 12th edition is out. So Retro Magazine is I think it's probably primarily in Italian, but it has English versions, and this is the issue 12 for January 2022. It is 81 pages long, so it is quite large and interesting. So I think we probably don't need to repeat all the stuff that we said about issue 11, but issue 12 is out.
And is this a subscription model?
As far as I can tell, I mean, we haven't looked into this anymore than since issue 11. But as far as we can tell, it is online only and free.
Oh, free. Okay.
So it's possible you can donate to it. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas on Facebook, what mysterious Thomas might this be, posted about the Fujinet and so as of that posting anyway, Fujinet has Total Replay booting on an Apple II off the cloud, off DigitalOcean. So that's very cool. So it does actually essentially retrieve the disk image from the cloud and boots an Apple II with it. And Total Replay is the sort of game collection that
Total Replay is amazing.
So it's you know, if you're going to run one thing, that is the thing you're going to want to run, and now you can run it off the internet. So you don't it sort of auto updates in a way. So that's a leap and a bound ahead for this.
It is both of those things.
So you may have talked about this when I wasn't on the show, mm-hmm. And since we've checked the bingo card anyway to talk mm-hmm. about Fujinet. Could you tell me how it interfaces with an Apple II? I know how it does it with an Atari. With the Apple II, is it a card? Is it an interface with an existing serial device? Or how does it plug in?
Well, okay, so I know that what it's doing is it is working over a smart port. So I think what that means is that it'll work on an Apple IIgs or a 2C+ that has one built in. And I think it will work on a slotted Apple II that has a Lyron card or one of the Yellowstone cards that's coming out from Big Muscle Wires.
Gotcha.
So
it might be possible with modern stuff to buy the things that you would need to get to this point that you're showing here.
Yeah.
Sweet.
And I think the Yellowstone, we talked about that last time or two times ago, probably both, actually. That is imminent. It's like the final run is underway, and it's not actually for sale yet, but it is about to be. So I think that'll be a pretty good solution for this. And so you need that piece, though, if you have an Apple II with a slot. And
that's going to be most people, isn't it? I think most people with an Apple II are going to have like a 2E or maybe a 2E Platinum or something.
Yeah, versus 2GS users or 2C Plus users, both of whom would have the smart port built in. Mm-hmm.
So the Fujinet device itself is relatively cheap, but that's going to be a second layer of device that you have to get. Still, the whole thing is not too expensive, and the idea that you can just run disk images off the internet is pretty amazing. And it does other things as well, but that's sort of like the prime thing.
But that said, like, there are currently a lot, just so people know, in case you're trying to get something, there are tons of devices right now you can get relatively cheaply for an Apple II, a slot Apple II or whatever, that will just take a SD card, what have you. You can simply download a disk image, stick it on that, and you're gold. So if you just want access to these things, then it's very easy to do so now. You just don't have that whole, I want to run it off the internet option.
Right. Oh, and actually there's one other, I've never tried this. I've been meaning to think about it at least. More seriously than I have, but there's another option, which is essentially to you replace the ROM on a printer card. I think we may have talked about this. It's called Soft SP for smart port, soft smart port. But you take some kind of host card, like a printer card, which you're not going to use anyway because, printers, who needs those? essentially that puts the code for the smart port in the address space, and then it can run normal like a disk drive, disk two, or actually it's the 5.25 drive card, which you can then plug stuff into. So it's a way to basically trick an old easily accessible card into providing a smart port. And the only sort of caveat to that is that it provides a signal that is a little bit dangerous to smart ports. So you have to, if you want to, cut one of the pins in the wire that you use to connect to it, but otherwise it's like a cheap solution. It's amazing that it works. I barely believe that it works. That's why I want to try it. But
right, that sounds dangerous.
Yeah. So the printer card just acts as a host. I mean, it's basically like a socket that you can put this ROM code in. And it is possible to use that to run a floppy emu, for example. But again, you want to cut that wire because otherwise you're gonna eventually fry your floppy emu, because it basically provides power on a pin that you don't want it to provide power on.
Mm.
Okay, so next thing we had, Tony wrote over email to talk about it's a Kickstarter for the Commodore Computer Museum. Did you guys see this?
No, I didn't. What is this? I'm so interested in Commodores.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I am actually interested.
This is in New Zealand, so you're safe from it, I think. But
I like my Commodore stuff to be the opposite, and the antipode for me, wherever I am, is where all Commodore things should go.
Right. This is basically someone in New Zealand who wants to kind of preserve the Commodore legacy in New Zealand, it has nearly a month to go as we're recording. It has a long way to go as well. I mean, it's got a $66,000 goal, and it's not very far along in that. But I think, I don't know if it's gotten very, I don't know if it's been around for very long. So let's not take that as a complete pessimistic outcome. But it's basically, a place to preserve the history of Commodore computers. And it's kind of, it's continuing an existing kind of endeavor. I think it's its goal is to be sort of grander, but there was kind of a Commodore Museum already that he kind of wants to continue, as I understand it. Anyway, it's actually too bad Michael's not here, because I think he knows a little bit more about this endeavor. Is this familiar to you, Earl?
Well, I read through it, and I think the cool part is I didn't realize how much unique history New Zealand had with Commodore computers. Apparently, there was a special business relationship there between Commodore and the way that they were sold and marketed in New Zealand. And also, it had a huge impact on agriculture in New Zealand. I think what you're kind of lingering on right there on the Kickstarter site, thousands of New Zealand farms were run on Commodore 64 and Commodore VIC-20. I can't imagine running a business endeavor on a VIC-20. It's just not enough characters on the screen, but I could see you doing it with specialized software and the Commodore 64. And they also mentioned that hundreds of pharmacies in New Zealand were run on a Commodore 64.
Oh, interesting.
And I just never saw that kind of uptake in the business realm in the United States on...
No, nor here in Canada. And like Commodore was essentially a local thing here for Toronto, but I don't remember that.
Nope. They were home computers. They were game computers. They were not business computers, but apparently not so in New Zealand. And also, the photographs and the aerial photograph that they have of the Commodore headquarters in New Zealand is just fun enough all by itself to go check out this Kickstarter page because it looks like it was a beautiful building.
Yeah.
It almost looks like a disk drive or a modem or something like that. The whole building, it's got this unique vibe to it.
Totally in favor of this. The reality is, like, computers, of course, have changed everything. The internet changed everything. Computers changed everything. Like, it's the, you know, our version of the Industrial Revolution. Everything's different because of computers. But the fact of Commodore and its history is different than the fact locally for every single country of how computing changed it. Mm-hmm. And I do hope that there are, like, if in every country, if you go to Malta, there should be, you know, how did computing change Malta? How was Apple's? Like, everybody should have local archives of these things because it is important for local history. And it's like here, Commodore in New Zealand is different than Commodore as a whole or Commodore in America. Mm-hmm. And so there's so many, all the time I encounter things like in America, let's save the history of whatever, but that doesn't save the history of it for other countries, like Denmark's history with the with the Apple or whatever. So I do applaud this, and I hope it's successful because I think the 50 years from now it's going to just be that much more difficult to get these things. So archiving efforts, the sooner the better, and the more local the better for this kind of thing. So obviously not hugest Commodore fan, but I would hope that this is successful, and I hope there's 100 more in 100 countries.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
And for, like you were saying, kind of for the computing that was important to them, like a very interesting thing, I was watching the RMC YouTube channel, and they were looking at restoring an Apple II computer.
Sorry, can I ask, what is RMC?
It's RMC, the cave. It is a...
Oh, sure. Sorry, I do. Yeah, sorry. Was just blanking.
Yeah, yeah. It's a great YouTube channel. And they were looking at an Apple II that wasn't working. They were trying to fix it up, you know, repair video. But the interesting thing was that one or both of the folks on the channel that were looking at this Apple II said, I've never seen an Apple II before this. And I thought, oh my gosh, they were everywhere here. But I guess in Europe, particularly in the UK, perhaps they didn't have that kind of, you know, market impact or whatever. It was the other computers that Commodore was big in the UK, and a lot of UK specific computers like the Sinclair series and the Acorn series and that were very important there. And so what's important regionally, I'm totally with you on this, Carrington. It's, I think that unique geographical history should be preserved as well as just the generic history of the computer.
Yeah, what you say reminds me of a good point that Paul made a few episodes ago about how, like, what was big in your school you think was big in education. But everybody else are like, I never heard of that before. But, like, you know, everyone has their own context for things. So anyway, I like local context computing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and you're not required to live in New Zealand to support this.
Right. No, yeah. So. That's a good point. So we should tell Waz that the reason he moved there was it wasn't necessary. You can come back and just support the Kickstarter.
Right.
He's like, oh, I've ruined my life.
Oh, by the way, just to skip back just for a second, Herb reminded me that Petr Puskarich, I think. He's got a name that many have trouble pronouncing, but I think I got it. He did a presentation at Kansas Fest last year on the SoftSP device, you know, that I was talking about before, that makes a smart port by cannibalizing a printer card. So, and yeah, the Apple, there was a European version called the Euro Plus, Apple II Euro Plus, that was in Europe generally, and I think many of them were made in Ireland. They're rare enough that I think they didn't make a lot of them. So I think it might just be, it was just expensive out there. So, and at least in the US, Apple really pushed hard into education, you know, so they made it cheap to get, you know, sort of first one's free. Or however that goes.
When you think of Apple, you think cheap.
Well, yeah.
Those inexpensive computers from Apple.
Right.
Free used all the time.
Ever.
Right.
All right. Let's see. And then this last bit of feedback. I thought so apparently this is, we had been talking about vinyl records and stuff usually in the after the show was ended or whatever part. Sean sent an email to sort of remind us or introduce us to the idea of the Aroma Disc. I don't know. Do you guys know the Aroma Disc?
No. What? No.
What is new?
The Aroma Disc. It is apparently, you can get an Aroma Disc player, which is a diffuser. It comes with discs that have scents on them. So this particular, the link that was sent was actually a link to a record that goes with your Aroma Disc. It's not it isn't actually the scent disc. It is music.
But it's the sound you'd want to play when you smell that smell. Okay. My biggest question is, and I really hope the answer is yes. I have a few ways you can do an Aroma Disc. One would be, it's like little liquid scented thing. And when you put the disc in, it opens up. But a better way would be, these are scratch and sniff records, and it uses a needle. When you put it in, it plays and it scratches it and releases a smell. And if that's the case, I might have to start collecting.
Yeah, these. I really don't know.
And I've got a record player, so I can, you know, play the appropriate sound.
I think you do.
Well, it's automatically scratching the smell for me.
Oh, that would be.
Oh, I'd be living in the future.
Oh, that would be interesting, actually. The way this did function was that there's a separate device. You have to get the Aroma Disc player. So this is the Aroma Disc player on eBay.
Okay.
A romance. TM. Aroma Disc player. This one's still for sale. This one's still sealed.
It has a full-on 8-track look to it.
Yeah.
Well, this,
I wonder how many smells came on a disc.
This would have been in my 70s cool pad with my lava
would
lamps.
Have you mean will be, baby, get your tenses right.
And my black light posters.
Yep.
And yeah,
but I mean, you know, this is a $22 buy it now. I mean, this is just it, the demand is not there.
Paisley. Lots of paisley.
This is one that was opened. It's already been purchased, but you can sort of see what the actual
and
discs
those are the
look
discs.
Like. Yeah,
they look like records.
They do. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it comes with four scent discs.
Amazing.
Actually, it looks like it would fit pretty well as like a TRS-80 accessory.
Or it would be great if it was a little smaller and could fit into a full-size drive bay in a computer.
Oh, yeah.
So you stick in your floppy and stick in your smell. It's like, oh yeah, let's get real.
Yeah. Anyway, that's I thought it was pretty nice.
Incredible. Yeah. I'm changing my eBay pick. It's all Aroma Disc from now on.
Here's sound. The Aroma Disc presents the sounds and scents of the holiday season. This is another audio record that comes with advice, basically about like what to play. You know, like
this was like a whole thing. This was not in my world at all. I've never encountered this.
Yeah. Anyway, so there you have it. Thank you, Sean, for making us aware of this.
I wonder if this was invented by people. What's that thing you get where you mix up your senses? Like orange doesn't look like a thing. It smells like a thing. This must be for people with that.
Could be.
Let me put on the smell of pine.
Anyway, yeah, I think it would be. It would be pretty interesting. It does seem like it might actually be a device that exists out there somewhere that has the sort of component bits of smells that you can mix together and could take digital input to tell you like what ratio and that sort of thing.
Okay. Oh, sure. Right.
It
okay,
must
cool.
exist.
So you could program smells? I'd be like hacking my sister's, oh, your room's going to smell like fart. What I'm done. Go.
Yeah. That one is probably a preset, you know, a demo one because everybody wanted that. Just that's the only thing anyone wanted to do.
And I know what sounds I'd put on the record to go with it. It'd be great.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, that's probably good enough for the feedback. And we can now move to items of interest and news. And Carrington's is the first of those.
My first pick is a nice easy one. It's an Ars Technica article. It actually came out a while ago, but it's been updated, and I find it interesting. So it's the title is How the U.S. Census Led to the First Data Processing Company 125 Years Ago. Doesn't mean it led to the first computer, mm-hmm. but it's an interesting thing. So the 1890 census in the States, like most census, people were dreading it because it takes forever, and it's a very error-prone thing to do. Like get everybody to say, I am this, one, and then you got to fill out the census and do it by hand. There's lots of mistakes. And so the census itself led to the invention of the punch card reader. People mm-hmm. were already using punch cards. So punch card readers were invented after punch cards. Punch cards weren't invented to be a computer thing. So way back in the 1800s, punch cards already existed. People were punching things. But a punch card reader, the idea of having a mechanical way to feed in a bunch of punch cards and then use that to tabulate data, to calculate things, was new and was invented for the census. So the 1890 census was the reason that this was invented. And so the census led to the invention of punch card readers, which then led to the idea that, hey, we're already storing data on punch cards and reading them in. Maybe that can be changed over to be a digital thing. But it all starts with pre-existing punch cards, then the 1890 census. And this is just an article doing an overall, like a bird's eye view of that.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. And actually it's somewhat prescient, I guess, in a way, because eventually as you scroll through the article, you will get to the point where in 1951, they got the first UNIVAC. That's where the first UNIVAC was delivered.
See, there
so
you go.
So we'll talk about it next time.
It all ties together.
But very cool.
That's it. Just a nice article. I don't think we talked about it before, but it's actually like an older article. It says from 2019, but it's been updated with a bunch of new info and a bunch of new links. So there's links to Hopper. There's links to Holworth. There's links to pictures mm-hmm. of the photos. So you can use this article as a jumping off point for a bunch of different things. And I thought it was well written. I like it. And I just like the whole topic. So that is my first item.
Very cool.
Early punch cards were on looms, weren't they? For some reason, I'm remembering the Jacquard loom.
Right, instructions.
I'm probably like crazily mispronouncing that, but
mispronouncing looms.
I think that's right. Loom. It's, last time, Beagle Bros came up, and you know, like the they have these funny things on the back of their discs or whatever, but they're also sort of like a whimsical company, and. So this is a little like, you know, this is in a catalog, but it's largely just, comedy. So this is a portion of it called Ask Uncle Louie, where it's questions and answers or whatever. And one of the things that's here in the corner of the page, it says tip. It says call one. It says this tip doesn't always work and it could be dangerous. But instead of typing call minus 151 to enter the monitor, type call one instead. If it works, you crash into the monitor. So that was the source of the thing that I mentioned last time. But the thing that reminded me of it was question. Dear Uncle Louie, when I bought my Apple last summer, I typed in that little 10 go to 10 program from your column. I typed run like you said, but nothing has happened so far. Please explain this to me. I would like to use my Apple for other things. Oh, when you answer, please don't use computer ease, as I am a total beginner. And then the answer is blank. But anyway, so I was reminded of that as a something that was in our chat was a 10 print go to 10 program. So, okay, let's see. Earl, you have the next thing.
Oh, and there are a couple of links to go along with this. It'll mm-hmm. be in the show notes. But Commodore aficionados know that there was an Easter egg. And I don't know why we call them Easter eggs in software, but little unexpected things that you can make happen if you do something special. And on the Commodore, if you said, this is the Commodore PET early version, if you said wait 6502, comma, and then some number, it would print Microsoft exclamation point that number of times. And it was an Easter egg put in by Microsoft. And I think why it was in there is a subject of some debate. Some people thought maybe Microsoft put it in so that other people wouldn't be able to claim credit for the basic, or, you know, who knows why. But it was in there. And then in later versions, it was discovered and it was taken out. So Leonard Trammell, son of Jack Trammell, was apparently, as he tells the story, he was at a trade show and Bill Gates came walking up and they had pets on display in the Commodore booth at this trade show. And Bill Gates had an entourage with him and he walked up to the pet and he typed wait 6502 comma some number and the computer just hung. And he was scratching his head trying to figure out why did the Easter egg not work. And Leonard Trammell kind of, you know, took him aside and said, oh, yeah, we found that Easter egg and we took it out, which is why the computer hung. But he realized, uh-oh, Bill Gates was trying to impress the entourage of people that he was with. So he kind of, you know, helped Bill Gates save face. And he said, yeah, we're, you know, very proud to be partnered with Microsoft on this computer language, blah, blah, blah. And then Bill was happy. But the title of this article that Leonard Trammell wrote was If Looks Could Kill. And I think the idea was when the thing didn't work and he's like, oh, yeah, we took that out. Apparently, at least from his facial expression, Bill Gates wasn't very happy about that being removed from their basic. So I thought that was just an interesting little legacy. And, you know, and part of what I thought was noteworthy about this was later, if I remember right, the U.S. government said, we can't have Easter eggs in our stuff. We prohibit undocumented features from being in software that we purchase for government use or something like that. There was a law. So Easter eggs that things had in them, like at one time, do you guys remember this? I think Microsoft Excel had a flight simulator in it. If you put the right stuff into Microsoft Excel, you could actually get it to drop into a low-function flight simulator that was halfway kind of fun. But, yeah, you couldn't have that.
Strong phrase.
Yeah. You couldn't have that for government work. But I thought this was kind of funny. This was, you know, one of those moments in time as remembered by one of the people that was actually there when it happened and, you know, a noteworthy person in computing history. So fun story. And if you go over to the other link that we'll have on pagetable.com, there is an exploration of this variations on this particular Easter egg in a number of 8-bit basics on Commodore and on TRS-80 color computer. So I thought that was kind of a fun read too and really well researched. So I think that'd be fun for folks to go have a look at.
Yeah, it's fun to try this out. This also exists in the AppleSoft basic on the Apple II. It's a little bit, there isn't anything quite exactly like this, but the string Microsoft exclamation point is in the ROM, sort of hiding after, I think it's like, you know, trigonometric tables or something. If you know where to find it and you know how to sort of do the right XORs to get it out, it is in there. And so it's kind of funny. I mean, particularly given how tight a lot of the monitor code is, it is a little silly that those bytes were wasted, but.
Yes. Yeah. Cause I mean, they were looking for every single byte back then.
Very cool. Yeah. The page table, exploration is also very nice. This is the guy, I think pagetable.com is also the, we talked about his like ultimate disk drive talk or something like that. I think he, he's
oh,
also the one behind
the Commodore 1541 talk that we talked about recently or something else. The one where he describes in excruciating detail how the 1541 works and the legacy of disk drives and tracks and sectors.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty sure. Yeah, here we go. Ultimate Commodore 1541 disk drive talk.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I don't know if that's, I mean, it seems that both of those things are great, and it turns out that they are both the same person.
Nice.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. I have the next thing. Yeah, this wasn't loading properly for me before, but okay. So what this is it's Nostalgic Computing Center, and it is located at nostalgiccomputing.org. If you go to port 8080, it will give you a list of these things. If it's working, as it was yesterday and is not now, then there's a sort of a front page that shows you kind of what this is. But it's basically a bunch of linked, emulated computers. And so on the screen right now, I have a list of the computers that are involved. So there's a Cyber 865 running four different ones running different operating systems, IBM 3033, PDP-10, PDP-11. And essentially what, so they're basically all emulated, but they're also networked so they can talk to each other. And if the front page were to load, you could actually see the connections between them, like, which ones are connected. And they're connected actually by, in period ways, so they talk to each other like they would have back in the, 80s. So if you go to one of the pages, it'll bring up a little thing that allows you to connect.
Super cool.
Yeah, and there's a place you can click that will let you log in. Actually, I went to look up the commands for VMS because I used this in college and I had totally forgotten like how any of it worked. But yeah, this is it.
Does that say version 4.7?
It does, yeah.
Interesting.
Is that, what does that mean?
Because Kay scanned a ton of VMS manuals that I had that I got over to him, mm-hmm. and I could swear that they were 4.something. You might actually be able to find manuals on archive.org for this particular version based on that.
Cool.
Or a version that's very close to it.
Yeah, so I really did not remember very much VMS, I guess if you want to change directories, it's set def games, set def trek, and then there'll be like a basic program in here that you can run. So basic run sam trek 1, and there we go. So there's probably easier ways to play Star Trek.
Love it.
So that's it. Check it out. By the time this hits the feed, maybe the internal error on the web server will be solved and you can see the topology that I was talking about. Hopefully I didn't break it when I was looking at it last night.
Way to go, Paul.
Anyway, yes. So very neat. I'm glad I came across it. I think it will be fun to play with.
So it turns out that the VMS manuals that Kay scanned were version 4.4. Which is probably going to be pretty close to 4.7.
Nope, totally useless.
Yeah,
way to go, Kay.
Excellent.
One of our hosts is in the chat. Hello, Michael.
Oh, look at that. Hi, Michael. Yeah.
We were talking about you earlier, but now you're going to have to wait for the show to go live to know what we said.
Maybe, but it was all good. It was all good.
Yeah, it was good. Okay, so let's see. The next thing is, Carrington, you have something about JavaScript.
I do, just a little thing. So a bit of deceptive headline on this, and Apple Watch was used to play the classic 1989 Prince of Persia. It's more that this is a two-part thing. One, Prince of Persia exists as an online playable thing, which is just a JavaScript version of Prince of Persia, so prince.js or whatever. Mm-hmm. So that exists. But somebody realized that there's no web browser for the Apple Watch. You can get a message with a link to a website and it will fetch that data and display it. And since everything from Apple basically runs OS X, it's able to execute this JavaScript. So if you either go to or send yourself a message or get someone to send you a message that just has a link to the prince.js JavaScript thing online, it'll pull up and is now playable on your Apple Watch. Now, by playable, I mean displayable, because come on, it's not actually playable on the Apple Watch. But it's kind of cool that you can say, okay, now here's a version of Prince of Persia. And because these old games have resolutions that are essentially in line with the Apple Watch, this thing plays perfectly fine and you can get a full pixel display up there because that's all it requires. So it's kind of neat that it made the rounds a while back, that everyone was excited. You can play by, and again by play I mean display, the game Apple II version of Prince of Persia on an Apple Watch. But it's more, I like this as a link because that's kind of funny and kind of neat. But it's as a reminder that that game, which is so good, is available in an online version that's just JavaScript. So you can play it online if you want to get a fix.
Excellent.
Yeah.
All right.
Hooray for Prince of Persia.
And that, I'm mildly distracted by the fact that my web browser is now singing to me because I clicked on
As one does.
Okay, let's see. I had one more thing. Which I will talk about, and then we can move on. But so this is this again. I think I came across this on the retro computing forum. But this is a post fairly recent about junk in the PCDOS 1.1 boot sector. And so it is this particular exploration and discussion is by Mikhail Netrasek, I think you would pronounce it. So. He basically goes through and talks about, you know, if you were to try to disassemble the boot sector on PCDOS 1.1, you will notice that there's some stuff in there that doesn't do anything. It's not accessed. It just looks like it's sort of garbage. And the question is kind of like, why is it there? What is it? What is its history? What have you seen, bytes? and so after doing a little bit of sleuthing around, the conclusion was, you know, so it's interesting to watch the sort of go through the sleuthing part, but the conclusion was that it seems to be a piece of Microsoft's linker, Link.exe, which means basically it's sort of left over here from the development process. And what's even cooler about that is that when you it's in format.com, which copies itself onto every disk. So this junk is on every disk. It's not even just on the masters; it's on everything. And in fact, actually, I think if you look into it even more closely, there's sort of two layers to it. So it's almost identical to what's in link.exe, except that it's like a slightly earlier version of link.exe. So you've got like a trace of an older version of link.exe on the master with the current version of link.exe. And anyway, it's very strange, but and apparently this was actually also sort of relatively simultaneously but slightly earlier discovered by Daniel Settori, aka the Starman, and he's got a really sort of elaborate and kind of old school HTML description of the boot sector of PCDOS 1.1, and sort of goes through like the stuff that's in it, and he sort of shows where the bytes are and talks a little bit about some strangeness in there. So for example, it's really sort of interesting, like looking through just the archaeology of this. So I don't know if it's in here. I think it's in actually the other write-up that what the boot sector does basically is it investigates the directory, looks for ibmbio.com, but it looks for it in lowercase. Because there was a time when the directory, you know, the system files were in fact actually in lowercase to make them hard to delete. So normally, you know, if you're interacting at the command line, you can't type lowercase characters. It would always uppercase them. But then they changed it and added a system flag. So then that was no longer necessary. And anyway, there's a full history in here that's pretty interesting. And it's kind of beyond my experience. Like, I know enough about DOS that, you know, these terms are familiar, com and exe and, you know, that sort of thing. But at the same time, I never was at the, like, you know, machine level of it. You know, like looking at the code in the boot sector is something that's sort of beyond me. But it's sort of pointing out that the boot sector actually has a pretty strange weirdness in it, in that these file names that it's looking for, ibmbio.com, they're both zero terminated and they end in a character with a high bit set, you know, so two ways that you can talk of ending a string. But they're not only they're zero terminated, but they're terminated by the ASCII character zero, which means that also this was an error. somebody terminated it with a string zero, but it didn't matter because it was already terminated with a high bit. And so it was never looked at. And, you know, like all the stuff that you can kind of deduce about the process. Anyway, that's it. I don't have more to say about it, really, but it's worth reading. I mean, like, there's a lot more detail in there than the mangling that I did. So have you come across this or worked at all with like, you know, PC DOS?
I came into PC DOS and MS DOS at version 2.
Uh-huh.
Never had any experience with version 1. It was just too early.
Yeah. And there's actually some interesting stuff if you look at the there's some sort of like disclaimers and warnings about if you're trying to use modern, you know, even slightly more modern than PC DOS 1.1 machines to read it, it's a problem because the essentially everything after PC DOS 1.1 would treat these as unformatted or improperly formatted and can't read anything off them. That's it, I guess, then, for the items of interest and news. And now, a word from our sponsor.
Buying a Commodore 64 computer would make you smart. But buying a 65XE from Atari would be smarter. Both have the same amount of memory, both have typewriter-style keyboards, but the XE has better graphics, better sound, more colors, and it's faster with thousands of software programs, including the best games. And for under $100, it blows the Commodore away. The XE computers from Atari, starting at under $100.
The magic of fragrance, captured on Aromadisc Fragrance Records. Play an Aromadisc to fill your room with the aroma of your favorite fragrance record. Enjoy the romantic bouquet of roses, an ocean breeze, a fireplace, or any of a variety of fragrance fantasies. Aromadisc, the new frontier in home entertainment.
Look for this Aromadisc Fragrance Record Center at fine stores in your area.
Sir, is this your computer?
Yeah.
It's unusually thin, sir. Please open it. Is this large area the screen, sir?
Yeah.
Sir, the screen is abnormally large and unusually bright.
I know.
Not the usual computer now, is it, sir?
No, it's not.
A supervisor to Station 12.
It's a showstopper. The Hynote Ultra 2000 with the Intel Pentium processor with MMX technology from Digital.
And we're back. So the host's retro computing gift idea this time actually only just came to my attention just today. But I think it's a really cool thing, which is this is the Meow Toast Rev 2 half AA battery replacement. And what it is basically it's an adapter that lets you put what is the C number that this is?
Yeah, I'm going to say C is
2032.
Everyone knows these batteries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it lets you put a little disk battery in place of a half AA battery, which is what all the old Macs used for their battery backup and probably other things. I think the Next also had that in it.
Yeah, my iMac G4, I had to get one of those. Since I was replacing the stuff inside anyway, mm-hmm. So well, might as well get one of those. And they were available. I went on Amazon and I got a half AA, and so it wasn't a big deal. But this is much nicer and better for a long-term thing.
Yeah, because it's not the nice thing about these little disk batteries is they don't melt and destroy everything when they run out.
Mm. I like that feature.
So, and also if you've broken the lid on your, you know, these on the Apple boards anyway, these things were encased with a little snap-on top. That
snap being the operable
word. Right. Yeah. So when it snapped off, it snapped in half. But. At any rate, yeah. So you may well have broken this as you took it off to replace your battery, and you can get a purple one if you want to go with your.
I do want to. This is great. This is fantastic, and those batteries will be easier to come by long term.
Yep.
This is fantastic. I like this a lot. Yep. So just a little adapter to use those instead. Amazing. Yep.
So this is
amazing.
It is a 5-pack. It is. For some reason, it's listing it in Canadian currency for me.
As it should.
So it is.
God bless the Queen and all that.
$16.66 Canadian dollars for a 5-pack, yeah.
The other news today was Canada took over the U.S. and now you have to use our money, and we're sorry.
Yeah.
That last part wasn't news. We're just sorry.
It took me a second for that to register, in fact, with me. But anyway. Okay, so... So anyway, this is a nice cheap little thing. Particularly if you are doing anything that is Apple or Next related, this is probably relevant for you, and you probably want to do this. You want to get the batteries out, but if you don't get the batteries out, you want to put one of these in instead.
Well, you want to get the batteries out, but also computers run better with the battery. It's like they're in there and it's better. So this is great. I if I had known about this when I was going into the guts of my G4, I 100% would have used one of these instead of giving Amazon some money and getting a half double A. So this is fantastic. I like this thing and I want one.
Yeah. Yeah, I did exactly the same thing. And like, I guess they still make them. The ones that I got, they do at least have modern dates on them, the real half double A's.
So did mine. I was wondering if I was going to get an old battery or whatever, and I got one that looked like it was a recent battery, but I didn't trust. I'm like, half double A, what is this little tiny thing? I don't trust. I would trust this kind of battery much better. So watch batteries for the win.
Yeah.
Cool. Very cool.
All right. Excellent. So when you're done, you know, actually these are low, they're low in stock. So,
It's a 3D printed thing. Yeah. So is it really?
So yeah, hopefully there will be other runs of this due to the great Russian demand that RCR 250 has caused.
Exactly. We're going to send floods of people in to get this.
Right.
Well, I'm going to get one. So I'm going to send floods of me in to get one.
And I ordered mine before I mentioned this on the podcast. So
and that's why it's low stock.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so now we can move to eBay auctions, and Carrington, you have the first of those.
I do. I've got the first two, and they're both related. I've decided to think about the West Coast Computer Fair recently. You know, everybody knows West Coast Computer Fair. Mm-hmm. So a couple of items here, and one interesting and one really interesting. So this interesting one is 1988 West Coast Computer Fair program book. So it's kind of cool. Like, you look through a program, and if you're a collector of this sort of thing, it's $48, which, my gosh. But I can see this being a thing I never thought of collecting. You know, you collect magazines, you collect posters. I never thought to collect, or I mean, I wouldn't collect, but other people might collect programs from computer fairs, from computer things. And so, like, get all the Macworld programs, what have you. It would tell you what merchants are there. It'd be really interesting to see the keynote speaker. Is really interesting to see, like, who's advertising in it and what have you. So kind of a neat thing. So I'd like this as an item. So I found this by searching for West Coast Computer Fair on eBay, and then this one popped up. And so it was just the first one I saw. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, what the heck? But it's a buy it now of $48 US. This is still in US currency, even though you're switching over to Canadian shortly.
Right.
So neat. I don't know if the program is – I have no idea if these are rare, if these are not rare. Is it easy to come by these things or not? It's not like it's from the first West Coast Computer Fair. Right. But
this one's whatever. 13th,
so
1988.
Number 19, I think. So 1988, so it's the 13th one. So it's interesting, and I thought it was neat because I hadn't really thought of it before. But my second item is the cool one. And I was tempted to just buy this rather than put it on because it's a buy it now of $2.39. Like, come on, I should have just bought this. It's a button. Mm-hmm. Buttons are so much more fun. So it's a button from the 10th West Coast Computer Fair. You can put this button on your Beagle Brothers bag and make bonus friends. You'll make best friends. The bags get you friends. Mm-hmm. Buttons on bags make you best friends. That's a new rule. So this, for $2.39, you'll have a new best friend. It might be me. It might be me, folks. So, you know, caveat emptor. But I love this. I love this little button. So it's just a West Coast Computer Fair button. How fun. Just like the bags. I just like this as a thing. It's just neat. And it's, you know, a little over $2. Nice, cheap item. And I dig it. So West Coast Computer Fair button. How fun would that be? And there's two available. So one person gets one button.
That's right.
Another person gets the other button.
It's like
button,
a little locket and that's then, broken
and
in
then
the middle.
Sparks will fly. You will. Someone should buy this button. If one of you buy it, I'll buy the other button, and we'll meet at the top of the Empire State Building on Valentine's Day.
Yep.
Anyway, I like this button. $2.39. Totally worth it. Get the button.
Very cool.
Those are my choices. Fun items. West Coast Computer Fair. Hooray.
All right. Nice. Makes me wish I would have kept programs from the Comdex shows that I went to in the 80s, because we went practically every year. In the 80s and early 90s. And I have a whole bunch of buttons from back then. I don't have that button because it's a different show, but I've got a bunch of different buttons from, you know, the companies that were there in those days. And it's fun to look back at those, but being able to look back at the programs would be really cool. Like you said, you could see what companies were there, what sort of products were they pushing, who was speaking at the various events. Yeah.
Yeah, I used to go to the Macworld Expo for ages, the one in Boston, year after year after year, I went to that and I'd get programs, you'd get buttons. I had a bunch of CyberDog buttons and pens. I remember for 1 year, like, oh, I didn't keep any of that stuff. And it would be kind of interesting. I'm not really a collector, but boy, it'd be really interesting to browse through that stuff, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You know, even if just briefly, like, you know, you might get your fix if, you know, you looked at it once every six years. But
so you can bring a bunch of these next time to Kansas Fest in person. I can just browse through them. I'd love to read the magazines at Kansas Fest and then just leave them there. Right. It's one of my favorite things. I will go to the lounge, grab a magazine, read it, put it back in the garage, give away. Go, there you go. Yep. Then all I need is just short access to these things to get me all the enjoyment I need. But you could get it on eBay, read it, flip it back on eBay. Yep. There should be eBay for borrowing. I don't want to spend $48, but I'll give you $6 to have it for a week.
Ah, good idea.
Yeah, eBorrow. Yeah.
Right, replacing the bay with borrow.
Exactly.
Cool. All right. Earl, you have the next one.
Yes. So this is a Deck Rainbow computer, and I think we've talked about them in the past. The interesting thing about the Deck Rainbow was that it had a split personality. And you can even see that if you look at one of the photos in here of the motherboard. You can see it's got a Z80 and it has an 8088. It could run CPM, it could run DOS, it could slice, it could dice. And the industrial engineering of this computer is pretty fascinating too. I like the way it looked. I like the way that the disk, the floppy disk drives looked. Between the top and the bottom, it almost had these what looked like little pincer kind of things that would come together and shut the drive door, as opposed to the boring, clunky buttons, something like that. So one of the reasons that I picked this particular auction for a Rainbow is this is the Rainbow 100 Plus. It actually has a hard drive in it. And
I didn't even know that was a thing.
I didn't either. Not until this morning when I was looking at eBay auctions.
Interesting.
So slightly later enhanced model of the Rainbow.
Yeah, I have never heard of that before.
Nope.
That's really a Rainbow, sure, but I did not know about this.
And,
cool.
And I don't know what size that hard drive is. And the black of the hard drive bezel on the front there contrasts very badly with the rest of the look of the machine. I didn't care for that so much. Personally, this was interesting to me. And no, I'm not going to buy it because I'm trying to downsize, not upsize my collection. But I actually have the monitor that goes with this. And it's a little bit rare. It's a Deck VR241, if I remember the model correctly.
And you need it, right? I mean, like this doesn't drive other monitors?
I don't know if there's any solutions that are out there to let this drive another type of monitor.
There might be a reason to pick this up, though, if you're ever getting rid of your monitor, because then you sell them as a set, because this might not, if this needs a special monitor, who's going to buy it? And right now it's got no bids and it's only 99 cents.
Yeah. Right. It still costs a decent amount for shipping. The other thing is you still need the keyboard, and I'm not sure where you get one of the keyboards for this. But and also, they didn't know if it worked. They said it powered on, but you know that since they don't have the monitor that goes with it, it would not be possible to look at the output. This is one of those situations where I think it was reasonable that they couldn't fully test it, because without the monitor, you really can't.
Because you've got the only monitor.
Yeah. Right. Well, not the only one, but, you know, they're actually kind of rare. Now, the monitor that I have has a little bit of that CRT crud that can happen around the edges where the glue of the safety front plastic is kind of detaching. But it's not bad. It's actually not bad. So anyway, I thought this was a good auction because they were starting it off at $1.
Yeah.
They didn't want an unreasonable amount of money for it. And
they want an unreasonable amount of money, but they're going to see what they get.
Right. And they took lots of photos inside and out. And so, and they gave a very accurate, I thought, straightforward description of the cosmetic condition of the machine. I love auctions like this. So that's one of the reasons that I picked this. Well done.
Yeah. Is it the case? I have this vague memory that it's actually hard to format disks for this drive. Like, now that I'm saying this, I'm not quite sure that I believe it, but that the drive itself couldn't format disks. You had to kind of get them pre-formatted, and then you were sort of in trouble if you erased them because you couldn't reformat them with this drive.
Oh,
it's a weird drive in any event, but
there's a couple of other computer models that I know that's the case for, but I don't know about this one.
Yeah.
And this actually, I guess, had three modes. Something else I learned, that it could act like a VT100 terminal, as well as being those two different, running those two different operating systems with two different CPUs. So very interesting beast. I actually had hands on one of these back in the day. It was one of the models that we carried in the computer chain that I worked for. They didn't sell very well. I don't remember ever selling a single one, but I thought it was a fascinating thing to play around with.
Yeah, and it's pleasing that it's digital, you know, too.
Mm. So yeah, totally.
Yeah, I have whatever. I have no. There's no rational reason that I am so fond of that. The, you know, that little logo and that brand. But
yeah, but I am too. Something about it.
Yep.
Anyway.
Well, cool. If you buy it, Paul, I'll send you the modder.
All right, thanks.
on eBorrow.
Yeah.
Right, and you can pay on PayBorrow.
Excellent. Okay. Actually, there's the QX10 also had this monitor thing that, you know, like there's a specific monitor for it.
Weird monitor driven by a weird NEC video chip. Yeah, good luck with that.
Okay, so I have a number of things randomly selected. Here is one. I've never seen one of these on eBay, although I'm sure they've probably occasionally come up. But this is a VersaWriter. So it's kind of like a graphics tablet. I think it plugs in and acts to an Apple II. It acts like a joystick of a kind. So it's basically, it's got an arm. It's like a jointed arm that allows you to kind of move all around on the surface of this tablet. And then something about the orientation of the joints in the arm will tell it where the pen is supposed to be. So you could actually use this to trace stuff, right? So you put down a thing on the surface, and then you use this jointed arm to trace around the things. And this was actually used. One of the things that it's kind of famous for, at least in my head, is that it was used to do the graphics for the early online games. So like Mystery House and stuff like that. This is the device they used to draw things. And I'm sure the graphics tablet that Apple made is better than this. You know, this is a not very high resolution thing, but it's perfectly preserved. I mean, it looks like it has the box and all the pins on the plug. And so
it looks like the old school joystick connector that it plugs into.
Yeah, it's a like a 16 pin dip thing. So
yeah, this is Edward Scissorhands meets Koala Pad.
Right. So anyway, I the one thing that's kind of interesting about these things is that, like, I'd seen pictures of them, but I'd seen black and white junk pictures of them in magazines of the day, right? You know, because the black and white ad is much cheaper to run. You know, so, like, what's cool about seeing this in such good shape in an auction like this is that, like, this is a much better picture than we ever had of this, even though, you know, it was a thing from the distant past.
Mm.
So I think it's really neat to see it, even if I am not going to get it. What is it going for? Yeah, it's a $1,000 buy it now. Somebody knows very well what it is. but that's probably because there are like 9 of them left. Are you at all familiar with these? Either this actual model or this kind of input?
I'm familiar with that kind of input.
I think I saw something like this at Kansas Fest at one point. It wasn't a VersaWriter, but it was another thing that used that kind of pattern for drawing things.
The kind of thing still exists too for like copying stuff, for using pens to move a physical pen, and then it'll move a physical pen at another location. I've been to a few author signings where the author's in one place and you're in another place, and you slide your book under a thing and the video comes up and the author has a pen and they sign at their end and it moves a pen and it signs your book. So
interesting. Oh, that would be cool.
Yep.
That's pretty wild. Okay, let's see. Next thing. A1 system in a working condition, $777. It says the system is in working condition. Very, you know, it says if you zoom in, it says Apple Computer 1 there in the corner. it's surprisingly It doesn't really say. It says, for sale is an Apple One system in a fully working condition. See picture. You will get what you see. You have the choice to get the system with or without Bernie's mods in place. It is a replica. Of course it's a replica.
It's got to be a replica, right?
But
what are the things... I'm unfamiliar with the stuff that replica people have been doing to note their things as replicas, though, so I can't look at it and go, oh, this makes this the whatever version.
Yeah, and so I think it actually... There's a sense in which it's not misleading if you are in the replica world, because I think A1 is the name of one of the replicas.
Hmm. Okay.
But boy, it doesn't tell you much in here. So, I mean, like, if you were, you know, new enough to be dangerous to yourself...
Which I do.
And nothing more. You might think, oh, look at this. Someone doesn't know what they have, you know, and I can get this. But so, yeah, it is a replica. One thing that I thought was interesting, though, is that it says you have the choice to get the system with or without Bernie's mods. And I'm like, what are Bernie's mods? I don't know what Bernie's mods are. And so I dug around a little bit, and it looks like in the fairly recent past, like, so this is, I'm looking at the Apple Fritter site, a posting from October 2020 by Uncle Bernie. And the title of the post and the thread is, you know, part of the path toward rock solid Apple One builds. And what it essentially is basically just he's gone through with a great deal of sort of, electrical engineering knowledge and figured out what places that you should put capacitors on the Apple One board to sort of decouple some of the problems that it had. There were problems that one needed to decouple with capacitors that, with RAM, I think, where there's something called ringing and things like this that actually made a lot of Apple Ones sort of, or at least replica Apple Ones, unstable. And so not only has he worked out where to put these things, but he's also figured out a way to do it underneath sockets so that they're kind of like invisible, like, so they're fixed, but the board still looks like it would have normally worked, and so these are Bernie's mods, and apparently the person who is giving, you know, who has this auction is either has two of them, one of them with the mods and one with not the mods, or is not built yet, or I don't know what's happening exactly, but I thought that the mods were cool, so I thought I would bring that up. And so actually it's really interesting if you're at all interested in this stuff to just go through the posts by Uncle Bernie about the Apple One, because this is not the only one. There's all kinds of stuff, you know, exploring all kinds of things about like what the right capacitor values were and all that stuff. And it's written in kind of a strange tone. It's a little bit, I mean, you know, the Uncle Bernie really is kind of like a character as well, being played, you know. Setting you on his knee and, you know, educating you about like how this stuff works and having you guess, you know, giving you little quizzes about like why does this help and that kind of stuff. It's pretty interesting. So not anybody I knew at all. Apple Fritter is the, among other places, it's I think one of the home bases for Tom Oad's Apple One replica building and stuff. I mean, like, so this is where you would expect to find Apple One stuff. Is it news to you? It was news to me.
I've never heard of Bernie's Mods or that site. I was trying to look at the picture here to see if I could make out some of the date codes on the ICs.
Oh, on the eBay auction, you mean?
Right. Boy, it's kind of hard to make out, but it looks like some of the date codes might be 1982, 1984, which would mean they were new old stock chips or recovered from something, but not circa when this would have been an actual Apple One in 1975, 76.
Yeah, and that's people play that game, you know, like in different ways, you know. So some people want a thing that will work with stuff that's newer, that's less likely to be, you know, like just flake out. Mm-hmm. And some people want to have exactly what could have been, you know, used in 1976. And the thing is, actually, the problem with these is that a lot of these pieces, like, the only option is essentially 1976 era, because they don't make anything like them anymore. So they're super hard to find and can be pretty expensive to get. You know, like some of these, like these little, I think they're shift registers or something, they're really, really, you know, precious because they are for this board. it can be very expensive to collect these pieces.
A person that I met at the Seattle Retro Computing Society was creating an Apple I replica using one of the replica board designs that are out there, but was taking special care to do it with all period parts.
Yeah.
And it did cost according to him, it cost a decent amount of money to try to actually get parts that would be time period appropriate for the Apple One.
There used to be a shortcut you could take. There's a place called Unicorn Electronics, I think, that actually sort of sold kits. It would assemble the pieces that you needed for an Apple One build. And so Mike Willigal would often send people to them. I don't think they do that anymore. So they sometimes stock some of the pieces, but I don't think they do the kits anymore. And it was expensive, and you look at it and you think, oh, that's, you know, how expensive that is, and you think, I will go do it myself, and then you realize that if you go do it yourself, it will cost you a little bit more and a lot of your life. So, anyway, I just thought it was sort of interesting to have come across Uncle Bernie. Okay, and what else? A couple more here. I mentioned the QX10 was going to come up, and this is the context in which it's going to come up. This is a RAM card semi-disc with backup battery for the QX10 or QX16. So it's a card which is sort of, it's amusingly just a slab of RAM. I mean, it is just RAM chips as far as the eye can see. And it has a little wire that connects up to a battery backup. So it's a box that's outside that has a battery in it. And so the idea is that your RAM disk is somewhat persistent inside the QX10. And they show, actually, they show a picture of a monitor. This isn't the monitor I was thinking of, actually, now that I'm looking at it. But that is sitting maybe on a QX16, you know, showing that the RAM disk, you know, works. 1.5 meg semi-disk. Is this, Earl, is this something that you had come across, this RAM card? Like, this seems like it's a fairly unusual peripheral.
Well, it is, but my particular experience wouldn't really help to understand that, because surprisingly, the boxes that we used at Epson were typically just very stock.
I see.
They didn't have a lot of third-party peripherals or whatever connected to the systems that we used at the mothership. And I don't know if that's... I actually don't know why that is, but I didn't get a lot of experience with third-party add-ons.
Okay. Yeah, because there are two. I mean, like I said, the other auction I had was... this is a Comfiler hard drive.
I did have one of these.
You did? Okay. Again, I have this sort of like irrational, you know, fuzzy warm feeling for Comrex.
Mm-hmm.
So I never had a Comfiler, but I think I had a Comrex modem or something. And they did, you know, a number of peripherals for the Epson QX10. But anyway, so this is it's a hard drive, 10 megabyte maybe, and comes with the card to drive it as well. So it's sort of SCSI or SCSI like SASI, maybe. Sassy? Maybe that's supposed to be pronounced sassy. It always seems like they want to make a word out of this, and since they couldn't get SCSI to be sexy. So this has the card and the cable, and, you know, it's shown to be working or whatever. And I thought that was kind of neat. Doesn't come up very often.
How much for this?
This is $900. And
now, you know, this starts to eke into the territory of, this is a very strange retro niche, I think. Mm-hmm. You would have to have either some personal experience with something like this, or just be the total completionist that wants one of everything.
Yeah.
One of the things that I got with the Altair Hall when I got that group of computers was a set of a dual 8-inch disk drive from a company called ICOM that was part of the whole Pertec collective, as I understand it. And it's an oddball, I think, between the other gentleman that worked with me to restore the stuff. We probably had the only copy of CPM that worked with those that worked with that floppy drive subsystem left in existence. And so we were able to archive it, which was really cool. And then when I thought about it, I thought, yeah, but who cares? You know, all five of us care about this.
We get that feedback a lot.
Yeah. So I thought, you know, it's so niche and so, you know, out there on the periphery that if you find the right person, I think they would pay $900 for this, but you would have to find the right person. How are you going to find the right person that this would be that meaningful to them? It's really interesting.
But I could see it too in a way. Like if you really you spent a lot of your life interacting with a compiler, and I think this was one of the main, you know, hard drive solutions for the QX10. So there probably are a fair number of people who have. But of course, the thing is that the hard drive, who knows how long that's going to last? I mean, like what's really interesting here to the nostalgist is probably the case. You know, like put a solid state thing inside and have the case.
Well, and maybe the interface card.
Yeah.
And I don't remember if it had some sort of driver. I don't remember how you actually kicked it into gear. That those brain cells are long gone. But, you know, there are modern now MFM hard drive emulators that actually act like the, whether or not it would be compatible with the specific MFM drive that would be inside that chassis there, I don't know.
Yeah.
You might be able to change out the mechanism. And I never popped the lid on it, so I don't know if it's like a Seagate in there or if it's some oddball mechanism inside.
Well, and it is, I mean, honestly, it is a pretty generic looking box. I mean, in fact, come to think of it, I have a hard drive that is just like that. And I do have...
It's a different label?
Yeah, well, it doesn't have a label on it. It has two little lights up at the top, like a green and a red that was indicating like, you know, either read or write or power or something like that. And that little anonymous box, I have two of them now because I have, you know, I do have a strong, you know, nostalgic connection to them. And I didn't, the one I actually originally owned, who knows what happened to it. I think it got tossed at some point. Not by me, but at any rate, it's no longer with us. So, but it is a totally anonymous box. It looks pretty much like this, except it has little lights and no label. And yet I still, like, have the nostalgia for it. So.
Yeah, but I get it, though. I mean, I totally get what you're saying, where you can look at a particular logo, a particular brand, particular whatever, and have that crazy strong connection to it that differentiates the thing. I mean, that's just something probably everybody in this hobby shares. Mm-hmm. There's certain brands that I have a weird soft spot. The brand called Newer, Newer Tech, that's still around, that did a bunch of old Macintosh peripherals and mini docks and things for the Duo. And I've got such a soft spot for that brand for some reason, as if like I was an investor or something. Like somehow it's, if it does well, it's good for me. I don't know why, but it's weird. There's just some things that just like you form a connection to and it just differentiates it from the pack. So
I think iOmega was that for me. When I look at the earlier iOmega branding, in that
I have a strong association with a certain color blue and a certain color purple when it comes to iOmega. Absolutely. They have strong color associations with me.
I think I have an iOmega mug that, you know, I got.
iOmega?
I hope that's what they called it.
I hope so, too.
Anyway, and also the same seller has, this is Houston Pinball, but has a newly fabricated hard drive card as well. So this is a kit, I think it might be. So you actually have to, present the parts and put them together. And he's got sort of instructions on like what sort of fixes you need to do to it. But so if you had a drive and a QX10 and you didn't want an original card, but in fact are happy enough with a functional card, this is one. So anyway, okay. This... the only reason I brought this up is just because it made me laugh. This is the show notes comment I made was like, when all the good names are already taken, you just pick random action sounding words to make your game, and this is a Epic's Death Sword.
Of course it is.
And
way to go, Epic.
Yeah. And you know, it might be a good game or whatever, but and the guy's expression on it, it really does. Really does look like, you know, the photographer said, and it probably was actually painted or something, but it really has the look of someone who said, okay, smile and hold it for 5 minutes. Because, I don't know, someone's mother is very proud of this, I guess. I also had to...
You might know me as the Death Sword guy.
That's right. Yeah. The other link I had was the metal band name generator that could also help you come up with names for your game, like Undead Cadaver or Nordic Funeral.
That's awesome.
Okay. Next one I had. Oh, it's one of the most roguelike games. This is Rogue by Epyx. I actually don't see this come up very often. This is for the Mac. I really kind of like this this pricing tag as well. You can see it says 39 crossed out, 20 crossed out, 10 crossed out, and it's being sold for $330. So. But I mean, you know, whatever, it's rare, but it's kind of funny to leave those the like, we cannot sell this, please buy this price tag on it. I don't actually know this game, you know, I just know that people call other games roguelike, and so I thought it was interesting that this is the actual Rogue, or at least, you know, this is the marketed version of it. I think it actually existed on like mainframes and stuff before.
No, I think this is a later version they're just calling Rogue.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then very last thing, this is in honor of the episode number being 250. This is, I searched for things that cost $250. And I came up with the best one I came up with was an Atari 65 XE with two Atari Max cartridges that sort of have like combined games on them. Because I think by itself, a 65 XE is not a $250 machine. But I think if you throw these in, it's not insane, and they do, you know, it is in nice shape. But I'm not really in the Atari market, so I don't really know how far off this is.
What size are the flash cartridges?
Like this big.
Oh, it's the 8 megabit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got one of those. They're really cool.
Yeah, and I did actually look this up to see how much they sold out for on their own, and they're non-trivial to buy, just the Atari Max cartridges. So this is, that bumps up the value of the set a fair amount. Plus, the whole thing works. So,
were they that color?
The green and blue.
I don't know why. I feel
these
like
these are that color.
Yeah. No,
the 65 XE. They were that color. That's weird. I don't remember them being that color.
Yeah, this is that is interesting. It's I wonder if that makes it rare. it's black. It doesn't look painted. Although I suppose it's conceivable that it is painted, because I definitely have seen ones that are not black. Highlight like this.
I think the only 65 XCs I've ever seen are that silvery color.
Right, all the way around. Gray, like this, the color of the buttons. The chat confirms that it is painted. So not only with this auction do you get a 65 XE and the Atari Max cartridges, you also get a paint job.
Depends who painted it. I guess that gives you the value. Is it signed?
It looks nice, actually. I mean, like I like how it looks, and it didn't occur to me that it was painted. But it's true that when I went to look up some stuff about it, the only ones I saw were not black. So, very interesting. And somewhat embarrassing that I did not know that. But, okay, anyway, that's it. That's the end of my auctions. I did not find enough other things for exactly $250 to make it
worth. You didn't find 250 auctions to recommend?
That would have been the other way
to
go.
Did you consider it?
But, no, I did not. So I guess we made it to closing. Discussions.
Well done.
And Carrington, you are the alphabetically first.
Okay, what have I got? Rob O'Hara, one of my favorite people and favorite podcasters, has a new podcast out that I would highly recommend. I haven't actually listened to the first show yet, but it's Rob O'Hara. It's going to be amazing. It's called Like a DOS, because Rob comes up with amazing titles for everything he does. And it's going to be, so he's going to be playing through and reviewing old DOS games, and I am here for it. Rob reviewing games is great. He does Commodore stuff, and he's a great Commodore reviewer. I listen to his Commodore podcast. I listen to his, that's how good this guy is. I listen to his Commodore podcast. So I'm thanking him for doing a non-Commodore podcast I can listen to with less shame, tell the people about it. So like a DOS is its name. Everybody should run and subscribe, as I have. I'll be listening to it later today. I'm very excited for Rob to have a new podcast. That's cool. And the other thing I think I have is I read more than half of a book that I won't finish by Ken Williams. So he's got a book out about the days of Sierra. Like, so him and Ken Roberta Williams, King's Quest and all that. I've always been a huge fan of Roberta Williams because I think of her as like one of these people that made these amazing early adventure games, and like this woman did such cool things. So like, how could she not be amazing? I don't really know about Ken and Roberta Williams personally. Having read most of Ken's book, he's a total D-bag. Oh my gosh, I had no idea. Now, maybe he never used to be, but the impression I got from Ken Williams' book is Ken Williams is an a-hole. So this book is about him and his theory of management, how some people are A players and some people are B players, and like some people are C players, and C players are fine if you're going to work in a factory, but you know, that's all they're good for. But A players can become B players if you do the right things, and here's how. It's the kind of book that has quotes at the beginning of the chapters. So he'll quote people like Ayn Rand, because of course he will. He quotes people like Ken Williams. He has quotes at the beginning of his chapters, and he quotes himself. It'll be like, you know, the next great thing in computer will be this, Ken Williams, 1989. I'm like, oh my God. It's not done ironically. I thought for a while, there's a little while when I was reading the book, I thought, this is a parody or something, right? I'm just not getting it. No, nobody can make this book and not realize how they come across. But no, I think he is just a seriously living a very unexamined life. And he's an unironic libertarian, and he's a total D-bag. And I used to be excited that Ken and Roberta Williams are coming out with a new adventure game. They announced it back in May, and I was really excited about it. I will only pirate Sierra things from now on. Like, just my gosh, what an a-hole. So that is my review of Ken Williams' book. Don't read it.
Also, you will not buy the VersaWriter, since he used it.
Wow, I will not buy the VersaWriter. I had no idea. Maybe he used to be amazing, but he is, my goodness, what a guy. What an interesting fellow.
Interesting.
So, yep, I had no idea until I read this book, or most of this book. I can't even finish it. It is an unfinishable book, so I don't know. Maybe chapter 12. Just kidding. And then it gets better. I don't know, but
you should read the last page of the book just to make sure.
It probably cast some sort of spell.
Forget everything I said before.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
It does remind me. Every once in a while, there's a thing that reminds me of the thing. I think it's actually sort of a common thing that people will do to, you know, sort of elementary school age people, where they give them a little list of things to do, and they're largely just ridiculous all the way until the last one, which is like, you know, don't do steps 2 to 9 or whatever, right. You know, and it's the idea, the lesson you're supposed to learn as you read it through before you start like doing all the embarrassing stuff that it asks you to do.
Right. Well, it's more that this is about like his business acumen and stuff. And so there's a whole bunch of things about how when things go right, it's because Ken knows what's going on. When things go wrong, it's just, I had no control. I made this decision, but I was forced into it. The other investors forced me to make this decision on my own. I'm like, I don't think that's how decisions on your own go, Ken. Like, oh my goodness. Like, a lot of times people who have had great success will misconstrue the amount of luck or doing the right thing at the right time versus how much is like, boy, you are successful because you're inherently a great person. Mm-hmm. And he's fully in that other camp. Like, you'll be successful if you eat porridge, because I ate porridge and I'm incredibly successful. Mm-hmm. Okay, Ken, I'll buy support. Just, it's the lack of self-awareness is shocking, shocking. Whoever edited this book must have been thinking the whole time, wow, I can't believe this is in this book. It's from chapter one. It is, I've never read anything like it. It's unbelievable. So,
all right.
Ken Williams, D-bag. There's my review. That's
very interesting. Yeah, you know, it's rare that there's a negative review. So there we go.
I can't believe he's married to Roberta Williams, because he says some stuff about her in this book where I'm like, whoa, that must have caused a fight at home. Like, some serious negative things about her. He negs her like crazy in this book. Like, doing this thing, well, I told her how to do this, and oh, she's not really that good at it. And then has a part of the book where he says, I know she's going to have things to say about this. And then it cuts to like, here's Roberta's reply to this. And she doesn't say things like, yeah, I'm divorcing him because I can't believe what he said about me in chapter 3. I was like, whoa, I would never stay with somebody who said something. And he puts it in the book. I was like, whoa, dude. It's shocking. Shocking, this book. So
weird.
I can't remember the last time I read a retro computing book. I keep waiting, thinking, Whoa. That's remarkable. So.
All right.
Highly recommended.
Apparently. Yeah. Oh, also, I was reminded, if you are interested in DOS game podcasts, there is one that I've listened to a couple of called, I think, DOS Nostalgic. DOS Nostalgia Podcast. Yes, that's what it is. The DOS Nostalgia Podcast. Anatoly Sheshkin. It's foul-mouthed than RCR.
Oh, okay.
But it's interesting. It's a recounting an era that wasn't much my experience, you know. So like there were a few DOS games that I was aware of, but I wasn't really that into it.
I used to be aware of them because I was a little jealous I couldn't play them. Yeah. People would play these amazing DOS games and I didn't have the platform. So I'm like, oh, Commander Keen looks kind of cool. Okay, whatever. So,
In fact, actually the most recent DOS Nostalgia podcast from July 2020 is Commander Keen. And actually, also the first of the like a DOS podcast is about Rogue.
Oh, excellent! See, Rob knows everything. Yep. Rob's great.
All right, Earl, any closing notes?
Well, I haven't read any books for a while, so I guess.
Oh, I got one I can recommend.
I was going to say, I know what I'm not reading this afternoon.
Because I'm very subtle with my opinions.
So I have a project.
It's hard to read me.
I'm a little in over my head on this project, but I think it's going to be fun. So there was another fellow retro enthusiast that was getting out of some parts of the hobby, or at least selling off some of their wares. And I decided, even though I'm downsizing, I bought this because this is going to be cool.
I thought you were downsized.
Yeah. Nope. But I bought this. It's small. This is small. So this is a programmer. It's a kit, actually, for the earliest EEPROMs, the Intel 1702.
Oh, interesting. Very interesting.
And why would you want that? Well, there's some cards that go in the Altair that use it. And when I got the Altairs, I got a bunch of them. And I'd love to be able to program them because I think that would be fun. Here's the thing about the old EEPROMs.
100%.
They're small. They only had 256 bytes per chip. That's not kilobytes or megabytes. 256.
Just bytes.
But it was the OG EEPROM, like the very first ones. It also takes some really weird voltages to program, which is why the newer programmers, middle to newer, can't program them because they just don't have those voltages. And why would they bother? Nobody was using those anymore. But if you're a retro person, you might want to have one. So I got the PCB and the firmware chip and like 90% of the parts, and now going to DigiKey and Mouser to get the rest of
that's actually pretty cool. Mm-hmm. I can see why you would pick that up, even if you're downsizing. That's pretty neat.
These are the chips.
Oh, so, showing us on camera.
I'm showing on camera, and for those who are just listening, which is 99%
you're currently erasing the EEPROMs.
Right. So
I hope you weren't already programming those, Earl, because that's some bad news for you.
So there are two styles of chip that I'm holding up. One is your typical looking chip, the kind of black/gray chip, and the other is a white ceramic with gold pins. All of these chips have a quartz window in them, and that's really cool because it means you can look inside and see the actual circuitry that's going on in the chip. But that's not the reason why they have the quartz window. It's not like, you know, for tourists. The reason they have the quartz window is that you can erase these with ultraviolet light. So these
that's
are
the E and the EEPROM. Yeah.
Exactly. These are 1702A chips, 256 bytes, so don't spend it all in one place. And I'm going to make the programmer for this, which is a jillion little parts and a print circuit board and some transformers, but it's going to be fun. And it's going to be, you know, you want to be careful too, even when you press the button to program them, because I think one of the voltages is like 50 volts or 60 volts or something like that. Some insane amount of DC voltage that these took, but cut them some slack because these were the first on the block. So
cool. Very cool.
Yeah. But stay safe.
Yes.
Right. But also
cool. But stay
or
safe.
Or do it live on YouTube.
That's right. And,
you know,
yeah. Just in
funny
case.
When people shock me.
Stay safe when you're erasing them too, because the UV light that it takes to erase these EEPROMs is of a wavelength that is different than just UV light that you'll encounter in normal life. It will damage your eyeballs. So you get one of the cheap programmers off eBay, that's fine. What I'm going to do is when I'm using it, I'm going to stick it underneath another box also and use a power bar to turn it on and off. So there's no chance of that UV light coming out through a crack in the, you know, there's a little drawer.
You say that, but we know you're going to get a suntan booth.
Yeah.
And you're just going to like set them exactly. on your chest and have little goggles on and just like
yep.
zap yourself.
They will be erased and they will be completely germ-free when I'm done.
So. Excellent. You said that you were gonna work it with the power bar, and of course, my mind immediately went to like an edible power bar, and then I was reminded of the story from 15 years ago or whatever, about that like people in I think it was in Korea on the subway were using hot dogs to like use their to like run their phones because it was too cold, but the hot dog had enough wow. sort of like capacitance yeah. or whatever to simulate a finger.
Yes, I will eat a power bar, and then I will use one to release yeah. the chips.
Anyway, yes. Perhaps this is an indication that we've been recording for over 2 hours that
could be. To
talk about hot dogs on subways.
I was impressed by the word association.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what about you, Paul? Closing thoughts?
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I feel like I don't have much that's new to talk about. I'm still you know, scanning and organizing and that kind of stuff. It's fun.
But your scanner stopped working? Was it?
Oh, yeah.
What happened to your scanner?
Yeah, there was
recently?
So this is... I mean, it's just, you know, I did some scanner shopping, got what seemed like, you know, the best. It does seem like scanner technology has not really been a growth area, you know, so mostly scanners are kind of cheap and they work the same way. And, you know, all the reviews don't address the things that I care about. And anyway, so I got what I thought was a fairly good one, but there was a thing that was recurring in the comments about it, which was that people would say, well, you know, like the scanner, like when you turn it on, it does a little sort of like self-test kind of thing. And then there's a scan bar and it's supposed to sit where the buttons are. Like there's two sides to it and one's a hinge that opens up and one's the buttons. And some people were saying, you know, this isn't working. The scan bar is returning to the hinge side. And, you know, other people were saying, well, I talked to support and this is actually, there were some bad versions of the scanners that got out of the factory and, you know, something was installed backwards. So if this is happening, you know, I just returned it and got a new one. I didn't want to return it and get a new one. And plus I knew that this thing was working, but mine was now returning to the hinge side. And so I fought with it for a little while and I sort of looked at what it was doing. And so what it would do is it would, you know, bring the scan bar to the button side. It would turn on the light. It would sort of like whir around a little bit. And then it would give up and it would send the bar back over to the hinge side. And so what it looked like it was doing was it was like sensing there was a problem and it was giving up. For a while I thought it was sensing a physical problem. So there's another thing on these scanners. Thank you for mentioning this. I had nothing to say and now I'm talking for 20 minutes. But when they ship them, there's a lock that locks the scan bar in place so it doesn't, you know, jangle around during shipping. And they don't tell you that in order to use the scanner, you need to unlock it. So there's a whole lot of comments on Amazon and so forth saying, I can't get this to work. You know, it's just saying communication error or whatever. And the solution to that is you unlock it so that the scan bar can actually move. Mm. But so I was thinking that actually the symptom I was seeing was that the lock actually, there's no circuit involved in that. It's an actual like piece of plastic that holds the thing in. And if you move the lock, then it,
So it easily could have slipped or whatever and be like, blocking yeah. the header.
Yeah, so I was thinking like it was bumping into something, and so I actually took the whole lock switch out. Still doing it.
That didn't show anything.
So what I eventually discovered, I think, was, and it's still a hypothesis, but it's working, you know, now, which is that I think what it does is it scans, because when I opened it up, I'm like, you know, I'm getting nowhere with this. So let me look and see. There's like nothing you can do inside, but I opened it up and on the bottom of the glass, underneath the lip of where the plastic is. So like normally where it's not visible, there is a white, it's a white strip. Like it's not just glue. It's actually white. And I think what it's doing is it's actually scanning under that thing. And if it doesn't see white, then it knows something's wrong. And so it throws a communication error and you know, sends the sends the bar to the other side. And so when I cleaned it, it worked. So nobody told me that. It's not documented anywhere. They never tell you anything like, you know, here's how you open the scanner. They don't, you know, they're not expected to open the scanner. But anyway, so now I have learned something about how scanners work. I've deduced what I think is something about how scanners work.
You think you have.
Al in the chat says, yep, that's a white reference plate, which, given the fact that it has a name, means I may have guessed right.
Well done.
Yeah, totally.
But anyway, so now my scanner's back working, and so, you know, I'm sinking a bunch of time into that, but it's fun. I've run into the same problem I always run into, which is that I sort of feel like time's being wasted if I'm not scanning, so I scan things, but it takes a long time to process it as well. So the processing builds up, and this hard drive space goes down. And so I need to stop that and actually process some of the things, because I discovered that some stuff that I scanned back in like 2014 actually was subject to some kind of bit rot. I can no longer open some of those things that I scanned in 2014 that I never got around to processing. So very
irritating. And you still have the things?
Mostly I still have the things, yeah. So,
but I mean, not that it's not
annoying,
disheartening to re-scan a thing. It's terrible regardless. Yeah. But it would suck if you scanned it, got rid of those things. Oh, got that done. Oh, turns out, no, you don't.
Yeah, and that is the fear. I mean, like, there is a pile of things, which I do still seem to have, which I did, you know, specifically, I scanned them and said, like, I do not want these anymore. I want to, you know, they were scanned for content, not for preservation exactly, not for, you know, archiving for future generations. It was, like, papers and things that I'd read and written notes on and stuff. But yeah, it's a little sobering to see that that could happen, you know, because I have many backups of everything else but that. So anyway, and I may actually go through and look at my old hard drives, because I do have a box of, you know, heavy old hard drives that have errors that might still have those on them. But
right.
So by the bit rot, do you mean that the hard drive was giving you an error when you were trying to read the material that was on there, or that you were able to open the file, but it looked like it had been corrupted somehow? Or
yeah, it has turned into nonsense. And I believe the, you know, so the file name is there. I know what it was supposed to be, and even the date and all the metadata and stuff. But I think what must have happened is that it was on a hard drive that failed, and I had to do like a disk warrior, you know, file system repair on it, and it didn't work. You know, like it thought it knew where the sectors were, but it was not correct. So inside there's nothing recognizable. You know, it says PDF. That's it. But
rats.
So anyway, but it is fun to scan, you know, and see the things, hold the things, you know, learn stuff about things that you did not know. So anyway, yeah. So that's my not much to say moment. okay, anyway, I guess that is all of us, and we have made it through 250 episodes, so that's good.
It's a lot of episodes. Thanks.
Yeah, it's fairly astounding. But and so next time we will, not sure exactly what we'll talk about, but it will be something based on 1951. Okay, so that's it for the show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php, I think. Someday I will go and actually check that. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast.com. You can watch us live on YouTube, where you can see Carrington dance to the closing credits, if you wish. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. Send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com, and write a review on iTunes if you wish. That may do something. And until next time,
Retro Compute.